How are you holding up? Can you do one more session? Very good, very good. Well, my job tonight is to talk about the influence of the Reformation on the arts. And in order to do that, I'd like to start with a little bit of history. Most of you may know all this already, so I'll pop through it quickly. What century did the Reformation occur in? 16th, right, exactly right. Well, I'm going to call this "In the Beginning Was the Word" because the Word is so central to the Reformation. So the influence of the arts on... Does that work? Yeah, that's good. Can we run the light down a little? Maybe they can see this better. Thank you. Just a few theological things. There are differences between the pre-Reformation and the Reformation, the Roman Catholic sort of approach to things, and the Reformed way of looking. Well, there's an emphasis of the word over the image. As I talked about Chartres Cathedral, you notice it was mostly images. But the emphasis in the Reformation is on the word. In the Reformation, you get these new translations of the Bible. In fact, you know that the King James Version of the Bible actually codifies a great deal of the English language. And reformers before Luther were burned for trying to translate the Bible into English. Wycliffe in particular, maybe you know about Wycliffe, he died before they could burn him. But a few years after he died, they dug up his bones and they burned them. They were serious about, you know, this, what they considered heresy. So the word itself becomes extremely important. Luther's Bible becomes the codification for modern German. So the vernacular becomes extremely important. And you can imagine what this does to spiritual life for the people. If you had to go to the church to hear the priests interpret the Bible for you, if that's the only way you could do it, if you were illiterate or you couldn't read Latin at least, you had your own language but not Latin, you can understand why changing over to your own language would really have a big effect. And one of the effects was a kind of change of the center of the city from the cathedrals and the churches to the home. Because now that you can read it for yourself at home, fathers were teaching their children, you see, and husbands teaching their wives. And that's why this painting is such a big painting for me. This is a Rembrandt painting of a Dutch man, we don't know who he is, teaching the Bible to his wife, you see, reading it at home to her. That was a new and different thing. That's typical of the emphasis on the word. The emphasis of the vernacular over Latin, the same kind of idea, and then the emphasis of the change of the community from the cathedral to the home. The cathedral, in many of the European cities, even today, you can see the town, the old town, is kind of set around the church. The church is at the center. Well, that changed. Well, the 16th century was a century of a lot of conflict. We're just going to talk through the 100 years of the 16th century very quickly. There's early on, in 1509, Desiderius Erasmus, you may remember reading something of him, actually raised a lot of pretty serious questions against the Roman Catholic Church and some of their doctrine. He continued to argue for certain changes, reforms in the Roman Church without leaving the Church. But really, it's Luther in 1517 where he posts his 95 Theses, where we say we really get the beginning of the political changes and the theological changes that we call the Reformation. The very next year, there were Augustinian monks who followed Luther who were martyred in Holland, I think. Is Nick here? Maybe. Yes. Isn't that right? Am I right? There you go. There you go. Thank you. Nice to have a Dutch expert on you. Now, you probably have heard of Henry VIII. How many wives did he have? 6. Right. Why? Do you know why he had so many wives? He wanted an heir. Very good. He married Catherine and then decided he wanted to divorce her because he didn't have a son with her. And he wanted an heir to the throne, a boy, a male heir. Well, he went to the Pope and said, I'd like to annul this marriage. And the Pope said, nothing doing. That's not right to do. You can't do that. And so he said, well, I'll just start my own church then. And so he was excommunicated, but he said, I don't care. I'm going to create something called the Church of England. And that's where it came to be. And he then divorced Catherine and married Anne Boleyn, his second wife. Now, he did have a child with Catherine. Anybody know what her name is? Mary. Very good. And how about the first child of Anne Boleyn? Elizabeth. Very good. You know your English history. Well, later on, when he dies and the throne passes on to his, he did have a son who lived for a very short time, but then Mary becomes queen. She's the oldest child of Henry, and so she becomes queen. Well, you remember she's the daughter of Catherine, who was the Roman Catholic, right? So she continues in the vein of the Roman Catholics and starts persecuting this Church of England that her father started. And many people were martyred then. Many Protestants were martyred under Mary. So many so that they started calling her Bloody Mary. Maybe you've heard of that term. That's where that comes from. Well, she eventually passes, and the next person in line for the throne is that daughter of the second wife, Elizabeth. And Elizabeth, of course, is a Protestant. And so she turns the tables, and she starts persecuting Catholics. So in the midst of this century, after Luther, in England, things are in an uproar. For a while, it's very dangerous to be a Protestant under Mary. Then it becomes very dangerous to be a Catholic under Elizabeth. And there I have that, right. And then at the same time, middle of the century, Calvin is sending secret missionaries into France from Switzerland, from Geneva. And he evangelizes much of France, and thousands of churches come up in France. Reformed churches, churches following Calvin. And they're eventually called Huguenots. You know that term, probably. Well, the Huguenots in French France become pretty intense after a while. Before I get to that, though, I'll tell you the Council of Trent, what they call the Counter-Reformation, occurs between 45 and 63, and the Roman Catholic Church starts thinking hard about some of the Reformation's claims about them. Some of them they actually start to adjust. Many of them they double down on and say, nope, this is the way we're going to continue, and so on. So even within the Catholic Church, there comes some turmoil. So the century continues its turmoil. And then in France, going back to the French Huguenots for a minute, Catherine de Medici becomes queen in France, and she's a Roman Catholic from Italy, and France is basically a Roman Catholic country, and she decides that these Huguenots have gone far enough, and she instigates what they call the St. Bartholomew Day Massacre. Have you heard about that? Anybody heard of that before? Yeah. It was pretty grisly. Nobody knows exactly how many people were killed, but I've heard numbers upwards of 20,000. And they were just killed in their beds. They just sent soldiers into people's houses and just ran them through. Just wanted to get rid of all the Huguenots. Well, just another bit of information. The Spanish Armada is defeated by the English in 1588. The Spanish were the kings of the sea for many years, and eventually the English in 1588 sink them. In fact, there's an old joke that John Cleese tells that the Spanish today in the 21st century, the Spanish has created a whole new navy, and the navy all the ships in the navy have glass bottoms to their boats so that the new Spanish navy can see the old Spanish navy. He's an Englishman. You see why it's funny. And then at the end of the century, we have Henry IV in France establishing what they call the Edict of Nantes. And the Edict of Nantes actually ends the persecution of the Huguenots in France. He himself, maybe you remember, was a Huguenot. But when it came time for him to become king, the French said, hey, wait a minute. No king of France is going to be a Protestant. You've got to be a Catholic if you're going to be king. We won't let you be king unless you're a Catholic. And he famously said, do you know the line? Paris is worth a mass. That's exactly right. Paris is worth a mass. So he converts, ostensibly, to Catholicism, takes up the mass, practices Catholicism, becomes king. But then, in 98, rather, he eliminates the persecutions of the Huguenots. So for a while, the Huguenots are allowed to live in France in peace. It doesn't last very long, by the way. Henry IV's grandson is the famous Roi du Soleil, the king, the sun king, Louis XIV. You've probably heard of him. He's the fellow who built Versailles Palace. You've seen Versailles? Well, he, in his middle of his reign, says, I've had enough of this, no persecution. It's time to persecute Christians again, or Protestants again. So he revokes the Edict of Nantes, and all sorts of hell breaks loose. And that's, in some ways, why we have New Orleans. Because a lot of Huguenots came to this country and landed in Louisiana, named after Louis, of course, Louisiana. Or is it the other way around? Maybe the state, I guess the king was named after the state. No. It's right. The king. But here's what happens. Okay, now we're at the end of the century, 1598. And by the beginning of the 17th century, you have a divided Europe. 16th century, all this turmoil between the Catholics and the Protestants throughout the century, lots of hard things. I didn't even mention the peasant revolt in Germany, the war there after Luther, but loads and loads of conflict between the two. And by the time the sort of dawn rises on 1600, we have a divided Europe. Some countries have gone stuck with Catholicism. Like France and Italy and Spain, southern Germany in particular, Flanders, what we now call Belgium, was Catholic. And yet, on the other hand, we had northern Germany and we had the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Holland. Holland, you know, becomes a Protestant country. All of them are Protestants, and the English are Protestants too, but they're sort of a half-breed, frankly, because they're sort of Anglo-Catholic. It's not that much different in some ways. Theologically, eventually, it becomes truly Protestant, I think, in the hands of people like Thomas Cranmer and many others. But, by the way, he was one of the ones that was martyred by Mary. Did you know about that? Who were the other two? There was Cranmer and Hugh Latimer, and who was the third one? Ridley, thank you very much. Ridley. Those three fellows in Oxford were burned at the stake. There's a plaque in the road in Oxford that shows you exactly where they were burned. It's a terrible story. Do you know the story of Thomas Cranmer's martyrdom? Anybody know? Some of you know? He was called to recant his Protestantism, and eventually he was convinced to do it. He finally signed something and said, okay, I'm no longer a Protestant. But then he changed his mind. His conscience got the better of him, and he converted back to Protestantism. And they said, look, if you're going to do that, you're going to burn at the stake. And he said, well, you know, come what may, that's the way it has to be. And in the church that's there in Oxford, right next to the Radcliffe Camera, right there at the Radcliffe Camera, just next to it anyway, is where they held the trial, and they took him right from the trial right out to the street and set fire to him, like that, bang, like that. And the story goes that he put his hand in the fire first and said, I have to put the hand that wrote that retraction, you know, that recantation, that's the most offending part of me. It has to burn first. And he put that in the fire first, and then he died. Terrible story. It's a great monument to those three fellows there in Oxford. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, now we've got an England that is divided and has gone through all sorts of difficulties. We've got France that's gone through all sorts of difficulties. Germany that's gone through all sorts of difficulties. Certain the Netherlands themselves have been divided in half. Now they're half Protestant and half Catholic. So the profile of the countries of Europe, the sort of modern countries of Europe for the most part, are established by way of this Reformation. So it's into that world that we have what we call the Baroque period. The Baroque period starts, we say, usually in 1600 to 1750. Anybody know why 1750, by the way? You know? That's exactly right. So nice to have such students. It's the year Bach died. Really, the styles of music by the time Bach died had already changed. But Bach was such a monumental figure. He was kind of like a dinosaur, you know. He was a great, big, massive musical powerhouse in the year. But most of the other guys had gone to the new style, which they called Rococo by that time. But he was still alive, and until he died, they still called it Baroque. Anyway, that's how it goes from 1600 to 1750, and that's what I'm looking at when I think about the effect of the Reformation on the culture of Europe. Because it's starting in the Baroque period that you have a division into two, what they call, the art historians will tell you, are two sides of the Baroque. What they call the aristocratic Baroque and the bourgeois Baroque. The upper class Baroque and the middle class Baroque. And for the most part, upper class Baroque is associated with Roman Catholic countries. You find aristocratic Baroque styles in Italy and in France, and in southern Germany, and in Spain. And mostly the Baroque that we call middle class comes up in the Protestant countries, especially Holland. It was a really golden time. 17th century in Holland is a golden era for art and music and theology and the rise of the middle class. Frankly, the 1600s are when they started colonizing the rest of the New World. Right? When was the first Jamestown colony? 1607. When was the Plymouth colony? 1620. Right, 1620. When was Harvard founded? Do you know? 1636. It's just that close. It's just 26 years, or 16 years rather, after the Plymouth colony in New England. They planted Harvard. And they patterned it after Cambridge, by the way. Anyway, so you have these divisions and the art historians will tell you they're divisions in style. But you and I can see, if you push it into the theological realm, that it's the belief systems of the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant churches that are cropping up that change the way people look at the world. One of the ways that the bourgeois Baroque, the Protestant Baroque, looks at the world that's different is that they start thinking that individual people with their own experiences, not just in the church as a whole, but individual people become significant before God individually. God loves me in my own situation, my own day to day, right now. He's snatched me out of sin's grasp and taken, redeemed me, you see. And so no longer do you have to be a member of the Roman Church in order to somehow receive this blessing. It's a blessing that's given you directly from God, see? And so things don't come through the priests always anymore. We have an idea called the priesthood of all believers in the Reformation Church. And so we can minister to one another that way, you see? Anyway, things change. Those theological changes actually have a big effect on the economy of Protestant countries and on the approach to art. Because once, for the aristocratic Baroque, for the most part, the church and the state are the ones that are, commissioning works. They're the sponsors. They're the patrons of the arts, you see. And so if you're an artist and you want to work for somebody, you work for the church or you work for the state. Well, now that there's a Protestant push and a wealthy middle class growing up because they're colonizing the world, Holland has started to see all sorts of wealth coming into their middle class because of their expansions and so on, their theological beliefs, and the result was the middle class now has money enough to sponsor art, to start being the patron of the arts, you see. So, you see paintings like Rembrandt's Night Watch, which is really a group portrait of a bunch of sort of, what do we call it now? When you have a group that kind of looks after your subdivision. What'd you say? Neighborhood watch. That's what I was looking for. Thank you. Neighborhood watch. They're sort of the neighborhood watch. They've got all like their swords, you know, and they're marching out together. But he decided he was painting for them. They asked him to commemorate their group by painting. So some of the painters were actually now being sponsored by wealthy middle class people. So the patronage changed. Also, the style of art changed. Here are some paintings, if you can see them, that are typically Renaissance paintings, which are the period before. The Italian Renaissance was inspired by idealized beauty, by clarity and balance and symmetry. This is Leonardo up in the left. That's Botticelli on the right there. And, of course, this is another famous Leonardo, the Last Supper. And most of the paintings that they painted were typically polychromatic. You see a lot of different colors in there, blue, red, green, orange, all of that. But by the end of the 16th century and the Baroque begins, we have paintings that look more like this. This is much more realistic, do you see? It's not about idealized figures and fanciful perfections and so on, and balances and symmetries. They're really more about the particulars of the face and the particulars of the individual and so on. And this is the division into the aristocratic and the bourgeois. I mentioned that I thought England was a kind of a hybrid in the sense, in theological sense. They're also a hybrid in some ways in artistic sense. How many of you have been to St. Paul's Cathedral in London? Anybody? Super. Well, if you look at it carefully, you know that it has characteristics of the Greek and of the Roman. So it's very classical, what you might call classical. But it also has the sort of heavy weight of the Baroque. And so it actually is a kind of aristocratic Baroque building, I would say. Christopher Wren built this cathedral, this famous cathedral in London. But it's in England, after all. And England is no longer a Roman Catholic country at that time. So, but they're in between somehow that way. So you see it not only theologically somehow. I think the Anglican Church kind of is closer maybe in its liturgy to the Catholic than some of the more other Protestant churches. But also artistically, they're close together. So in the aristocratic Baroque, you have the kind of painters like Rubens. Rubens and the others were interested in biblical figures and mythological figures, aristocratic figures. Their church and state patronage stood still. So this is actually a painting that's at the Louvre Museum in Paris. It's of Catherine de' Medici coming from Italy to marry Henry. I think it's Henry IV. And you can see the great heavy figures, the great sort of stylized grandeur of it all. This is aristocratic Baroque style. But the famous Baroque painters that are more bourgeois are Rembrandt and Vermeer. I showed you a Vermeer the other day. Well, here's another one. This is one of my favorites. And this is Vermeer and Rembrandt. Both were, actually, Vermeer was a Catholic, but he painted like a Protestant, I think. But here's why. Because he was very interested in what I call domestic scenes. He was interested in average people, not grand people, not kings and queens and so on. They were just servants, like this servant girl here pouring milk. Well, they told about Bible stories. They told about middle-class figures, domestic scenes like this one and so on. And the patronage was associated with the middle class for the most part. And I told you about the emphasis on the vernacular. And the center of the town becomes the home. Well, I'm not going to talk much about the music of the period, because if I played music for you, I'd run out of time. So just suffice it to say that the aristocratic Baroque composers are Monteverdi, to begin with, Vivaldi, and George Frederick Handel. My old history teacher used to say, Frederick Handel, he was a German composer that wrote Italian operas in England. And that, if you can remember that, that's exactly what he did. He was an opera composer. Most people don't know that. Handel's known for his oratorios, right? His Messiah, for example. And they wrote lots of other oratorios. But in his own day, he was famous for operas. He wrote loads and loads of operas. Nobody plays them anymore. But he did write lots of them. And he studied Italian opera. So he was an Italian opera composer. But that makes him a very cosmopolitan kind of guy. That makes him more aristocratic. He was a German, it's true, but he learned Italian opera and he performed many of them, wrote many of them in England. He was in England when he wrote Messiah, and it was first performed in Ireland. But the more bourgeois Baroque composers are associated with Luther and his musicians, people like Heinrich Schütz and Dietrich Buxtehude, and of course the J.S. Bach and his ancestors. Actually, his parents and grandparents were all Protestant composers as well. But Bach was the greatest of them all. Okay, so, but this is one little detail about the difference between the older music, the Renaissance music, and the more Baroque music. And it comes about because of the emphasis of the word. The Renaissance pieces, I was talking to some of you musicians about Renaissance music. I was talking about Victoria and Palestrina and some composers like that. They were very involved. After the Counter-Reformation, they were very involved with trying to clarify music so that you could hear the beauty of the harmonies and the beauty of the sound of the music. It's all very lofty and very idealistic, spiritual, sort of disembodied music, not a lot of rhythms and heavy beats and so on like that. If you listen to Palestrina, it's glorious music. But it's sort of otherworldly. It's of a kind of spiritual plane. The words were not as important for Palestrina as the harmony and the music. You actually can find in his masses some of the same music with different words. So at one point maybe they're singing the Gloria, another point they're singing the Credo in the mass, but the words very different. But the music is just as the same style, sounds very similar. But the Baroque was different. The Baroque, the difference between the Renaissance and the Baroque in music is mainly that the Baroque stressed the words over the music. And so you get music that starts to do what they call tone painting, which is taking the words, figuring out what the word meant, and then composing the music to express the word. Instead of composing the music to sound beautiful and then just putting the words in it, whatever words you have to say, it's the other way around. You start with the meaning of the words. Think about Handel's Messiah. If you'll forgive me a second, I'll sing something to you. Handel's Messiah, the first tenor aria in Handel's Messiah is "Every Valley Shall Be Exalted" from Isaiah. Do you know that? Do you know the aria? Every valley shall be exalted. Have you heard the tune? But then he does something very strange. He goes, shall be exalted, like that. Hear a real tenor sing it, and it's wonderful. But why would he write that? What's the point of that? What is all that? Well, what does it mean to be exalted, but lifted up, right? That's what he's talking about. The music goes, it's being lifted up, you see? And then he says, the crooked straight, and the rough places plain. It's not by accident, you see? So that's taking the meaning of the music, or the words rather, first, and then crafting the music to, in a sense, express it. That's typical of the Baroque period. Along with that, you start seeing in Monteverdi and some others in Italy the beginning of opera. And eventually Handel, by the end of the period, he's writing all sorts of operas, lots and lots of. Opera is just very dramatic music, and it's written for usually for one person to sing a dramatic, what they call an aria. Okay, I'm gonna before I make myself go too deeply into that, I'm gonna jump all over to Shakespeare for a minute. Shakespeare is an interesting character. He is born about 5 years or so into Elizabeth's reign. His father was a Catholic, though. Now, there are a lot of debates going on amongst scholars about whether or not you can call Shakespeare a Christian. I think that's foolish. I think there's no doubt in my mind that he was a Christian. The only doubt in my mind has ever been, was he a closet Catholic or was he a Protestant? Because in England, in his lifetime, that was a big deal, right? And it was actually a very dangerous thing to be the wrong one at the wrong time. Well, his father was a Catholic, but he was baptized in the Anglican Church. His father baptized William in the Anglican Church. And later on, when he got married, he baptized all of his children in the Anglican Church, the Church of England. So, on the surface anyway, he was a C of E guy. He was a Church of England Protestant. Okay. Now, I've had plenty of people who know better than I do say, there's no doubt about it, he was a Protestant, there's no question. But it's an interesting question, because his father was a Catholic. So, now what I want to tell you about is I want to talk about Hamlet. And the reason is, Hamlet was started, in 1599. So it's at the very end of this very long and tumultuous 16th century, just as this Baroque period that I'm telling you about is beginning. Hamlet is written. Hamlet starts in 1599, and he goes through several versions of it, and I guess it's first performed maybe in 1603, something like that, about 4 years later. But I want to talk to you about Hamlet for a minute, because I have a theory about it. Hamlet is called, the title of the play is The Tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. Now, you know about tragedies, right? Tragedies are usually end with death. And sure enough, Hamlet dies at the end of Hamlet, if you know. Well, it's a different kind of tragedy, though. My argument is that Hamlet actually is the first tragedy of the modern world. That is, the world after the Reformation. And I'm going to give you my theory about it, okay? So put your seatbelts on. Most of the tragedies that you think of come in the pattern of the Greeks. Oedipus, the king, was a tragedy. Oedipus was a great man. He was a terrific man. He's a very wise man. He was the one who was able to unravel the riddle of the Sphinx. Well, remember that? Or not the Sphinx, the Oracle, the Delphic Oracle. Anyway, he figured it out, right? He's smart. And it was prophesied early on in his life that he would kill his father and marry his mother. Well, in order to avoid that, they threw him out. They actually gave him away to be raised by somebody else. He wouldn't even know his father and mother. And as you know the story, he eventually meets a man and kills him and heads into town and meets the queen of the town and marries her and becomes king. But later on he finds out that the man that he killed was actually his real father, and the woman that he married was his father's wife, his own mother. And at that point, of course, he's horrified. Don't ever let anybody tell you that Freud understood the Oedipus. Okay, he talks about the Oedipus complex and so on. Oedipus was not at all interested in marrying his mother. Okay, there wasn't anything in his heart that wanted to do that. And when he found out that that's what he had done, of course, you know what he did, right? He blinded himself. He tore his own eyes out. It was it's a terrible moment. Anyway, that's tragic. That's tragic. The very best kind of person can't escape his fate, you see. He can't get out. His flaws lead him to his own doom, as it were. And the cathartic aspect to it all was that the audiences that watched one of these Sophoclean tragedies like this would say, I need to see myself humbly. I can't have the kind of arrogance that people like that had. If the greatest of us, somebody like Oedipus, could fall into his doom this way, not escape his doom, what does it mean for me, an average Joe, see? Okay, well, that's kind of what tragedy is. When Shakespeare writes tragedies all these years later, 2,000 some odd years later, Shakespeare writes a whole slew of them. You know them, Othello, King Lear, Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, Antony and Cleopatra, all of them are tragic stories in the same way that Oedipus is tragic. You have a very strong character, somebody who has some potential good in the world, and he turns wrong, he goes wrong. Othello is a great leader, great man, but he falls to his doom because of his jealousy. Iago convinces him to kill his wife, you know about the story, Desdemona. Well, same thing with Macbeth. Macbeth is actually a pretty decent general at the beginning of the play, but he falls prey to his pride and wants to become powerful. His lust for power leads him, and his wife helps him, to murder Duncan the king and take his place. And it doesn't work out very well, does it? Well, what's different between those kinds of Greek-ish tragedies and the tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark? In Hamlet, Hamlet's uncle, as we talked about the other day, Hamlet's uncle has murdered his brother, Hamlet's father, and has taken over the throne. Sounds a little bit like Macbeth, doesn't it? I've always thought maybe the play ought to have been called Claudius, the tragedy of Claudius, you see, his uncle. But it isn't. It's a tragedy of Hamlet. Why Hamlet? What is it about Hamlet that's tragic? It's a different kind of tragedy. Let me see if I can walk through it with you. Hamlet ends with actually something that's not so tragic. I mean, it's true, he dies. But Hamlet, in his death, well, I know, but I mean, there are worse things than death, right? You know that as a Christian. The Hamlet actually writes the wrongs in his kingdom before he dies. He actually brings justice to Denmark. Of course, he dies in the process, it's true. But in a way, that's kind of heroic, isn't it? It's a strange kind of tragedy to be heroic at the end, to do away with this dastardly uncle. Well, for the first four acts of Hamlet, Hamlet is himself a very confused person. If you've read the show, you know he pretends to be crazy. He meets, he meets the ghost to begin with, and he doubts the ghost of his father. Is this true? Is this some sort of devil that's come to sort of lead me astray, or is he really my father coming back from the grave to tell me that he's been murdered and needs me to seek revenge? So he decides, first of all, he better not show Claudius that he knows about all this stuff. So he feigns insanity. He feigns being crazy. And then he thinks, I know what I'll do. I'll get this wandering troupe of actors to write a play, or write into the play, a scene where a man comes and kills his brother, the very way that the ghost told me my uncle killed my father, see? And I'll watch the king, and I'll see. Therein I'll catch the conscience of the king, he says. And sure enough, when this happens on the stage, the king goes nuts, Claudius. Goes crazy. Light, bring me light, he says. And Hamlet looks at him and says, you did it. You did it. I know it, see? Okay, now what do I do? I don't know. If you attack the king, that's treason, right? You can't do that. What do I do? I don't know, he says. So he's constantly wondering, how do I do this? So at one point he acts very rashly. He's with his mother and he's all angry at her for having married this uncle. And somebody is behind the curtain. And he thinks it's the king. And he says, here's my chance. And he draws his sword and he runs him through, only to find out it's his girlfriend's father, Polonius. Oops. So he acts very, when he does act, he acts very rashly, right? Bad idea. Later on they ask him, where's Polonius? And he says, at dinner. And they say, at dinner? And he says, not where he eats, but where he's eaten. In other words, the worms are eating him. He's dead. He's gone. Well, okay, so he acts crazy. He kills Polonius in a fit of rash, right, rash fit. And then, later on, he comes across his uncle saying his prayers alone in the chapel. And he says, aha, here's my chance. I could kill him right now. And then he stops and he thinks, wait a minute. If I kill him while he's praying, his soul will go right to heaven. That's too good for him, see? I'm going to wait until he's drunk and in debauchery and all this, and then I'll run him through, and then he'll go to hell like he deserves. That's what he says. So when he has the chance to actually act, he doesn't. You see? So all through these first four acts, he's either not acting, acting strangely, acting rashly, or missing an opportunity. All sorts of mistakes, okay? Well, I mean, and of course he broke up with Ophelia too. That was another big thing he did. Oops. I wish I had it memorized. I don't have it quite memorized. Hang on just a second. He disappeared, and we never saw him again. I think I have the speech here I wanted to show you. This is a famous speech, but it gives you a taste of who he is, honestly. He says this speech. This is one of my favorite speeches. He says, I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, foregone all custom of exercises, and indeed, it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave overhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appears no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me. That's Hamlet. Revealing his real heart, I think, early on. But something happens. Something happens. In the beginning of the fifth act, he's a different person. In the beginning of the fifth act, something has happened. And you know what it was that changed? You know what he changed? What changed him? He's much more confident. He knows what he's going to do. He trusts in providence. He thinks everything's going to be all right no matter what happens. I'll read you that dialogue with Horatio in a second. You know what happens? Pirates. Pirates. I'll come back to that. I think the play describes the context of the 16th century. I think Hamlet is a 16th century man. Confused now. Up until the 16th century, up until the Reformation, we've had only one church. It's true the church has been difficult, had all sorts of difficulties within it, but there's only been one Western Christian church, the Church of Rome. Now with the Reformation, though, in a sense you have two different authorities, and everybody suddenly has to make choices. Which way do I go? What do I do? Am I with the Romans? Am I with the Protestants? Am I with the Lutherans? Am I with the Calvinists? Am I with, you know, even among Protestants, you have to start making decisions. Things started to change. And this, we don't understand how this is, but back then, that was a radical change for the spiritual authority of the day to now be divided, that you could actually be saved in several different places, was a different idea. Shakespeare's own father was a Catholic, as I told you. And so Shakespeare himself was very much aware of the dichotomy, as it were, the moment, the day. And I think at the end of this tumultuous 16th century, he was very much aware and wondered what European man was going to do. Where do we go from here? And I think in Hamlet, he actually gives us a little hint of how to do it. And he does it in the person of Hamlet. He has Hamlet for four acts acting very strangely, not knowing what to do. And then something happens that has to do with pirates. And then Hamlet is at peace. Let me explain. In the play, you have some Roman Catholic doctrines worked out. For example, Hamlet's father, the ghost, appears and talks about being in purgatory. So there's purgatory. He says, "But at night I'm allowed to walk about, but during the day, every day I go and I suffer terribly. It's awful," he says. He tells Hamlet it's terrible. Hamlet has a kind of superstitious, if you will, way of looking at Claudius when he has the opportunity to kill him in the chapel, and doesn't do it because he thinks if he kills him while he's praying, he'll go straight to heaven. Well, where do you get that idea? That's not a Protestant idea. But something happens at the end of Act 4. If you remember what happens, Claudius decides to send Hamlet. Nothing's worked for Hamlet, right? Claudius says, "I tell you what, why don't you go and be my emissary to England? I'm going to put you on a boat with your buddies Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, two not-so-buddies, they're his betrayers. And they sail off to England. And they sail off to England with a sealed document from King Claudius to the King of England. And in the document it says, I want you, King of England, to execute the guy who brought you this letter." So in a sense, Claudius is dumping Hamlet off on England so that he will get rid of him, you see. England will get rid of him. Well, along the way, Hamlet actually breaks the seal of the thing and reads it and is horrified by it, realizes he's trapped, he's on this boat, can't help but go on to England now. What's he going to do? Who shows up? Pirates. Pirates. Out of the blue. Nobody expects pirates. No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects pirates. Where did they come from? I don't know. But you know what they do? They get into a battle. The two boats come together. We read this in a letter that he wrote end of Act 4. He says, the two boats came together. We fought and fought, and the two boats separated from each other, and I, Hamlet, found myself on the boat with the pirates. Oops. So the others got away, see, and he was captured by the pirates. Thought, this is the end of me. The pirates, you know what they do? They go, "Hey, wait, dude, aren't you the Prince of Denmark?" And he says, "Well, yeah." "Oh, good. Well, we'll take you home." And the pirates do nothing to him. They take him right back to Denmark and put him down and just go, "Have a nice day." It's a true story. You've read the play, right? You remember the scene? Well, okay, they didn't say "have a nice day." But they did take him home. They took him back to Denmark. So he escaped this execution. You see, he was going to be executed. And as we find out later on, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, in their dim-wittedness, take the thing to go on to England and take the thing to him, and he kills them. Justice. Okay. So, what? If you know anything about writing plays, you've heard of the expression Deus ex machina. Do you know that? God in the machine. It means the author got the characters in the play into such a complicated situation, he couldn't get them out of it. And so he just has God come in and sort it all out. You do this, you do that, and everything, and keep quiet. And off he goes again, see? Straightens it all out. Well, it's a kind of it's considered a cheat. It's a cheat. The story has like in a murder mystery, you can't at the last minute bring in another character nobody's ever heard of before and say he's the one that killed the man, you know. You can't do that. That's not fair. You see, you have to be within the story. So that's how it is with Deus Ex Machina. Everybody says, well, that's just a writer's cheat. You can't do, no good play does that. Well, looks like Shakespeare did just that. He had Hamlet up on the wall and he said, what can I do? I know, pirates. Well, hang on a second. This is William Shakespeare we're talking about. This is not just some fly-by-night second-rate Hollywood writer. This is the greatest English writer in the history of the world, right? Maybe he had another reason. Maybe he had another reason. Why would he bring pirates? Because it teaches Hamlet something. What did it teach him? It taught him about providence. It taught him that God was in charge of the whole thing from the beginning, that all of his life has been under God's hand. Let me read you the exchange toward the end of the play, you know, the middle of Act 5. There's only one scene, I think, in Act 5. Maybe there are two. But there's a scene with Horatio. A man comes in and says, Hamlet, the king would like you to come and do a fencing exhibition, fencing duel with Laertes, two good fencers. They just want to have a competition. It's kind of like a foot race, kind of a friendly, you know, thing. And Horatio, when the guy leaves, Horatio says, Hamlet, I don't think this is such a good idea. Well, it turns out we know, Hamlet doesn't know, neither does Horatio, but Hamlet, or we know, the audience knows because of a previous scene, that Claudius is conniving with Laertes, who's Ophelia's brother, by the way, right, to kill Hamlet in this duel. And he gets a sword and puts poison on the tip of the sword so that if he can scratch him, even he'll die. That's all. Just get a little nick, and that's all it'll take to kill him. See? So they work this up. Laertes wants his revenge because Hamlet's killed his father. By this time, Ophelia has been drowned. She's drowned herself. So his sister has been killed because of Hamlet, you see? So Laertes has a bone to pick with Hamlet, right? So Claudius says, I know, I'll use Laertes to get rid of this troublesome nephew. Okay, that's what's gonna happen at the sword fight. Horatio has a bad idea about it. He says, Hamlet, I don't think this is such a good idea. This doesn't sound right to me. If you have any problems with this, just say so, and I'll go tell him you're not fit for this, you're not interested, you don't want to do it. Let me read you the exchange. Horatio says, you will lose this wager, my lord, the wager in the competition. Hamlet says, I don't think so. Since he went to France, I have been in continual practice, that is, sword fight practice. I shall win at the odds, but thou wouldst not think all how ill all's here about my heart. He says, I am kind of concerned. But then he says this, he says, but it's no matter. Horatio says, nay, my good lord. And Hamlet says, it is but foolery. My worry, my anxiety is just foolery, he says. But it is such of a kind of gain-giving as would perhaps trouble a woman. Maybe women would worry about this kind of thing. It's beneath me, though, he says. Horatio says, if your mind dislike anything, obey it. I will forestall their repair hither and say you are not fit. Just what I said a minute ago. If you feel this in any way, tell me, and I'll go tell them you don't feel, we're just not going to do it. And here's what he says. This is the crucial line. Hamlet says, not a whit. We defy augury. You know what augury is? Predicting the future. Worrying about the future. Prophecy like that. Like, you're going to die, you're going to learn, you know, lose. We defy that. And then he says this. Listen carefully. There is a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be now, that is my death, it is not to come. If it be not to come in the future, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all, is everything. Since no man has aught of what he leaves, what is it to leave betimes? Since nobody knows when, and nobody knows what he's going to leave behind, he's in the hands of God, what difference does it make? He's not cynical in the slightest. He says specifically a very New Testament sort of thing. He says, God, providence, knows the fall of every sparrow. How is it that he gets from, oh, that this tutu solid flesh would melt, fall, and resolve itself into a dew, or that maybe the everlasting hadn't fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. Why can't I just kill myself? How does he get from that, and to be or not to be, that is the question. All the way to providence, he says, not a whit. We defy any predictions. God is in charge, and if I'm not going to die now, I'll die later. If I'm not going to die later on, it's in his hands and I die now. What difference does it make? I'm in good hands. That's a hugely different person. And it's because, I'm convinced, it's because of the fact of the pirates. The pirates came along, and suddenly he saw that the world is not something that I have to fix myself. You know how he, at the beginning when the ghost tells him, you have to revenge me, you have to bring about my revenge, you see. And he says, oh, my prophetic soul, I knew it. I knew this had to be them. And then later on says something like, oh, that I was ever born to set it right. The world is out of joint, and the spite that I were ever born to set it right. My job is to fix this. And it's like the weight of the world on his shoulders, you see. And after trying and failing, and not trying and failing, and screwing up and failing, and murdering and failing, and you know what I mean? Four long acts, he finally gets to the point where he says, it was in God's hands all along. That is what Shakespeare tells us. I'm convinced. That's what the play is about. Even in the midst of the Reformation, even with all the pros and cons of both sides of this split between the Catholics and the Protestants, with all of the horrors that have happened as a result of siding one way or the other, all the political intrigues and so on like that, it seems so big and so impossible to work up. What we find is that God is actually in charge and we can be at peace. And to prove that my theory, I have two proofs. One is, as soon as he figures that out, and 6 pages later, the play's over. Everybody's dead, the world is back right, and it's all over. If he had started this way, it would have been a very short play. But he learns that by the end. And then the last little bit of proof for my little theory is this. Where was he coming from when he came back at the beginning of the play to his father's funeral? Where was he when he came from? Do you remember? He's a student. Do you remember? Nobody knows? It happens to be Germany. But what was he doing in Germany? He's studying at college. He was a college student. Now the question is this. What college was it? Because it's mentioned. It's Wittenberg. Do you remember where the 95 Theses were nailed? Wittenberg. Shakespeare doesn't do anything accidentally. Everything matters. He could have had him off at Cambridge or Oxford or Paris, Heidelberg, loads of places, Bologna. He could have been anywhere. If it's just a toss-away fact, why wasn't he at one of those other colleges? He was specifically coming from Wittenberg, the center of the Reformation, where it all began. So that's my theory. And the very end, if you think of it as a tragedy, think of it a little differently than when you hear this, because Horatio's last line to Hamlet as he dies is this. Now cracks a noble heart. Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels, sing thee to thy rest. You Hamlet have died setting things right. You finally got your heart right. And then you bravely went in and did what needed to be done and put the world right. God used you to put this wrong right. And when Fortinbras comes in, he becomes the new king of Denmark. And he honors Hamlet. He says, take him and give him honor. And fire the guns in salute of this great fellow. So it's not just tearing your eyes out and living the rest of your life in horror. You see what I mean? It's not King Lear who at the last, actually there's a bit of redemption in King Lear too. I won't pick that one out. But Othello has almost no redemption. Iago gets away with it and Othello is destroyed. Antony and Cleopatra both die. Terrible. Romeo and Juliet. There's a bit of redemption in Romeo and Juliet too if you read the prologue. It's not the death of Romeo and Juliet that's the tragedy, or that's the redemption, I mean. It's the death of Romeo and Juliet that bring the two families back together again. There is resolution. So there's a new kind of tragedy that's not completely tragic. But I think it's the result of the Reformation and that fantastic century of turmoil that leads to creating really maybe the best play that's ever been written. I think I've gone over time. I better quit. Thank you all very much.